Blog Talk Radio. With the Global Product Management Talk, coming to you on Monday, September 10th, from the San Francisco Bay Area. Today we are talking about Gestalt Product Strategy with Prabhakar Gopalan, who is Austin's expert on strategy. He will discuss his ideas on applications of Gestalt perception to product strategy and how to build products with the Gestalt mind. The Global Product Management Talk is designed as a weekly mini product camp Socratic discussion where we pre-post the questions and we have live audio of the thought leader with the co-host commenting with the Twitter back channel so that we can bring product talks to product professionals wherever they are. It is designed for passionate product professionals and business owners who want to teach, learn, and network about what it takes to produce successful products in an open digital environment, inviting live participation. Our vision was to flip the webinar on its head and use technology to enable a many-to-many conversation, which Twitter is perfect for. So if you are following us on Twitter, please use the hashtag #ProdMGMTTALK so that you can follow everything that is said with that hashtag. If you are just following our Twitter handle at ProdMGMTTALK, I will retrieve your tweets after the talk, but I won't be able to respond directly. So this is set up to showcase a thought leader from the product management community or from surrounding domain expertise to share what they're thinking about, methodologies, practices, and everything involved with developing, designing, and launching products, innovation, and startups throughout the entire product lifecycle process to guarantee successful products and companies. It's something that I find people care about, but I haven't really seen it talked about as product integrity. You can find out more about us by going to our website, www.prodmgmttalk.com. If you were on and heard our intro theme music, thank you to podcastthemes.com and the great Mark Blasco. We are a top 10 business podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network, receiving an average of 10,000 listens per week. If you would like your brand engaged with our audience of tech professionals and product professionals who listen for over 50 minutes on their personal devices, please sponsor us. This week we are brought to you by the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, which was founded in 1998 and promotes worldwide excellence in product management education and provides value to individuals, corporate members, and sponsors with training, education, certification credentials, and professional networking opportunities. The AIPMM 7-Phase Product Lifecycle Framework is a vendor-independent product management and product marketing standard that takes into account best practices used in a wide range of companies and industries, ensuring that the most modern and up-to-date challenges faced in product management and product marketing are addressed for today's environment. Please visit our sponsor at www.aipmm.com and subscribe to their newsletter, the weekly AIPMM Product Management News and Views, www.aipmm.com/subscribe. Okay, today we are talking about applications of Gestalt perception to product strategy. Gestalt is a German word that means a configuration or pattern that cannot be derived from the sum of its parts, but can only be represented by its unified whole. Product management is often caught up in the weeds and in the details of adding one feature or widget. But how do you approach product strategy as a whole? What are some illustrative ideas of Gestalt product strategy? How can you and your organization benefit from it? This discussion is intended to be about ideas and Gestalt perception and its application to managing products and product strategy. Our showcase speaker, Prabhakar Gopalan, is here with us from Austin, Texas. He is an expert on strategy, an entrepreneur, and a product guy. He is the founder of Simple Idea Labs, and one of their first experiments is Kanban2Go. Check it out at Kanban2Go.com. He writes and talks about products, strategy, and chaos, and he wants us to know that his opinions do not reflect those of his employers, as I think that should probably speak for all of us. And our co-host today is Lydia Sugarman of Ventiv.com. She is founder of the startup Ventiv, V-E-N-N-T-I-V-E.com. If you are following us on Twitter, we suggest using TweetChat, TweetChat.com. You sign in with your Twitter account, and you put in the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK at the top, and it will automatically add the hashtag to your tweet. So, is there anything that I left out?
Cindy, thank you very much for the opportunity here to speak, and I think you covered everything. Thank you.
Okay. So, I want to give Lydia an opportunity to introduce herself and welcome as a first-time co-host.
Oh, hi. Cindy, thank you so much for inviting me to participate. This is an unexpected pleasure. Ventiv is my company. It's also our platform, and it's a unique comprehensive platform that integrates probably more than a dozen applications under one umbrella. You no longer have to subscribe to an email marketing application, a marketing automation application, a social media deck, CRM, event management. It's all deeply integrated on one platform.
So thank you, Lydia. I will forgive you as a first-time co-host for plugging your business. And I will schedule you to be on Startup Product Talks, which is a pure audio where I talk to founders of startups, and they can plug away and talk about their site and their product. Let's go back to Prabhakar to give us some context and orientation about Gestalt. And in a previous life, I was a psychotherapist. The history of Gestalt psychology and therapy and philosophy is something I studied, so it's very interesting to apply it to product management.
Sure. I think our first, since you have laid it out nicely as a question and answer kind of format, so if I look at the first question, tell us more about Gestalt and its origins in the context of product management. The first thing, as you rightly pointed out, I want to make sure people don't confuse this discussion with Gestalt therapy, right? So there's going to be no discussion about Gestalt therapy, which is extensively researched and documented. And second, I'm not a neuroscientist or a neurobiologist, so nothing I touch will be related to the brain in this talk. So that's also gone. And then if those two are gone, then what else are we going to talk about is just take just the literal meaning of Gestalt, right? Gestalt in German is for the whole being greater than the sum of the parts individually. So we all know it is intuitively true, right? We all know that your five fingers together form your hand, your palm together, all of that, you have more strength than one individually, or just if you were to add them together, they probably not good. So that is the Gestaltness, the whole picture. For me, how I got introduced to the idea of Gestalt was some years ago, I took an actual perception class, Drawing Right by Betty Edwards. Actually, her son, Brian Baumeisler, teaches this class in New York in his studio, as well as in a few other cities. And I took this five-day drawing class, and it changed my life in the sense that it allowed me to go and look at drawing as a completely different, an approach to drawing, different from how I used to think about drawing. And part of it was, her philosophy was about the Gestaltness, or the wholeness of what you draw. It's not the nose or the eye or the hair, but they're all coming together. How do you get that together, right? They're elements of of drawing, of those individual things. And you get that only by shutting off parts of your brain, literally, that look at things individually. And it's a very complex thing to do in the beginning. But as you get through the class, you see how you can actually shut off those portions of your brain that want to see the eye as an eye. They don't want to see the eye as the space around it, the shadow around it, the lines around it. It's very, very perceptual. And those principles, if you ask me, can be applied very much to strategy. Those principles can be applied to product management, very much so. And so that's really the essence of, or really how I got introduced to the idea of gestaltness is like, wait a second, if you look at the most successful products, the founders of those products, or the people who conceived them, approached it truly with a very whole mind approach. That's really the basis for this.
So did we talk about how your gestalt strategy arose? How did you come around to this way of thinking?
Sure. And again, I didn't invent gestalt strategy. If you go and do a search for gestalt strategy, there isn't, except a mention that I found on Google by Henry Mintzberg, who's one of my favorite thinkers on the planet, and he has written extensively about strategy or the lack of it. He talks about the learning, the experimental or the emergent ways of strategy as opposed to a very pre-informed or strategic intent ideas that much of the practitioners, you know, management consultants and such formulate. In the resources section for this, I'd like to share that link too. When people get a chance, they can look at those two cases that he talks about the U.S. war in Vietnam, as well as the Volkswagen, you know, car company, the automotive company in Germany, and how their strategies evolved over a long period of time. Another is the famous Honda case. And Mintzberg has done an extensive study on strategic patterns, and he mentions about the gestalt strategy or the gestaltness of strategy. What is it? There are two elements to it. One is the uniqueness. It's got to be unique. And what does, you know, it's what we call as differentiated strategies, right? It almost like you have to first lay out what you're competing and then say, oh, I will differentiate on this aspect, as if it is an afterthought. But reality is, most people take that pole position very early on. If you look at examples all around us. And a simple example, a very common, popular example in business schools is Southwest Airlines, right? And how did, you know, they do point-to-point routing. They don't have a hub. They didn't start with, let's go build an airline with a hub, and then let's also now go and do point-to-point routing, which is what the other guys tried to do, right, once they saw Southwest doing it. But they failed at that kind of strategy because point number two, which is integration. So for making the first thing, the uniqueness, stand out, you have to actually look at the wholeness of it. It is not possible to go to market with one differentiation, which is your pole position, or how you're going to present the product, without knowing what elements you need to integrate and go to market with it. So when you look at other airlines, for example, who are already operating in their hub and spoke models, if they try now to add this particular as an additive strategy and say, now I'm going to run small airlines, they just would not be able to, on many levels, on many vectors, they cannot compete because their employees weren't incented to perform in the same manner that, you know, point-to-point airlines was designed. Their aircrafts weren't designed that way. There were several reasons to it. And we see this again and again, right? My point is, you know, there are two elements. If we were to summarize or we were to just look at Mintzberg's concept and extrapolate that and look at ourselves and the products around us, and if we want to go build those products or we are running those products, we got to think about, will this work or not? That is already a predeterminant for what will work and what won't work. So differentiation for the sake of differentiation or me-too strategies, all these fail. It's because they forget the gestaltness of it, right? Because they realize that, wait a second, for that to happen, sales, marketing, your distribution channel, all of those were set up to do completely a different thing, right? The whole was a sum of different set of parts. You can't create it based uniquely based on what you now want to do. And so that is a very, very important thing for product managers to understand. It's not adding the new feature. when you look at products, you know, I'm going to compete with, you know, this product is going to compete with that product. We have to actually, strategy is mostly saying no to those things, right? Because if you try to add those elements, then your integration fails. And if your integration fails, your uniqueness then fails. And uniqueness fails, your product fails. So that's a very important concept.
Mm-hmm. Talked about Southwest Airlines, and of course, their founder, their CEO, is an extraordinary man who built a very successful airline company when a lot of other people failed. What would you say is the kind of person who is best suited for implementing Gestalt strategy?
Sure. We can break this down into two areas, right? One is small organizations, another is large organizations. So that is based on the, if we draw a 2x2 matrix, right, you have organization size small, organization size large. And then you look at the other axis, and you look at founders versus professional managers or bureaucratic movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
In that scope, if you see that 2x2 matrix, when the organization is small and the founders are running it, the chance of making a Gestalt strategy is very high for it to succeed. You see startups becoming successful very quickly or fail quickly too because of, you know, bad strategy. But startups do have a theme around them, right? They are mostly one product company and they have a certain vision, the founder's vision, and they go and execute that. It's kind of very easy to do that because they don't have the other two aspects of it, which is the large organization or the bureaucracy around it, right? Now flip that and look at a situation where when the company starts to add more products or when the company starts to add more people, more professional managers, for instance, or more organizational elements, then it kind of gets hard, if you ask me, to have a unique, differentiated strategy and then also have, you know, execute on the same integrated gestaltness, right? And think about it. If Southwest went and played the same idea, now that we have this point-to-point, I'm going to expand it to Mexico and operate in Mexico, that is expanding to markets. Another one is, like, I'm going to expand it to products. I'm going to try to do something else different, which is, like, go to the American or United kind of model where I will do. They will have the same effect as the other guys had trying to copy them. And if they hired different professional managers and they came back and said the founders had a specific vision, but if those new people who came didn't understand what was the success of this company but tried to change it to a different company, they're going to have the same situation. So to your question on what kind of people, I think usually founders are best suited to run this. Almost all successful companies, if you see, founders have been extraordinarily, like, take Google, for example, right? Take some of the biggest, you know, successes. The founders have had a very important role to play for many years. Take Warren Buffett, right? He has a portfolio of companies, but that's all of those companies remain as they are. So in one case, his vision is there, and then the visions of the other people also, he has left it very hands-on to the people who run it, not trying to, you know, go and do their strategy. So those are best ways of doing Gestalt strategy. People
right.
And the foundation of it will have problems.
What I'm understanding is that people with a strong entrepreneurial streak and a strong vision, not only what is now, but what can be in the future, are those who are naturally suited to implementing Gestalt strategy.
Yes.
Okay.
And there's another point also, like, suppose an organization, let's say the founders left, and then the organization is going through a turmoil, right? And then somebody comes in and just shakes the whole thing up. It's almost like starting a new organization because this. So let's say Marissa Mayer, who just joined Yahoo, is able to do something brilliant. We don't know, right? Let's say she is that person. So she, at least she's expected to do that. She has a vision. So she cleans up whatever is not performing well, or she changes, but she has the opportunity to do that. So,
mm-hmm.
And being given empowered to do that. Then, so there's also the situational dynamic for this, where if an organization is just doing a good job or is steadily, like, you know, 5% a year growth or 10% a year growth of revenue or whatever the case may be, every year they're adding, it's kind of hard to change that, to do a transformation of that, right? Because the environment around it doesn't demand it. So you'll see organizations that grow on a very steady, you know, calm, measured pace are unlikely to, maybe because their gestalt is already set, and that is fine, unlikely to waver from it. Either at the founding stage, when it is just going to have, so the product managers at that time have a vision of what their product should look like, or when they're down and out, or in a turmoil, and then the new person comes and changes it. Those are the kind of opportunities for gestalt. You can't just go into an organization and, like, here's my new vision, guys, which is another reason why strategies fail, if you ask me, is people are already bought into a strategy, right? Mm-hmm. That's, it is go, the boat is already going in a certain direction. Unless there is a crisis, the boat is not going to turn another direction. It's kind of hard to sell a new strategy when the existing strategy kind of works.
All right. So I have all these thoughts running through my head about, you know, when you talked about, well, the gestalt strategy, once a company is set on its course, it's not that you said it doesn't need gestalt strategy anymore, but they don't practice gestalt strategy, so to speak. And that made me think about, you know, the book Good to Great and how many of those companies lost their gestalt and ultimately failed. On the other hand, you had GE and Jack Welch came in and really did do exactly what you said. It was a huge company. It had been around for decades, but it had gotten complacent, and he came in and really shook things up and had a vision that nobody else probably could have imagined. I mean, who would have ever thought GE would go into the TV business and buy NBC?
Exactly. And so Welch's vision, you rightly pointed out, is like, you know, he came at a time when GE was in too many markets doing too many things, and he said, he had a very simple vision, right? Either you're one or two, or get out of the market. So he basically closed a lot of businesses, right?
Yeah.
In the businesses that he thought was strategic for them, they had to go and become one or two. This is a very simple idea for people to understand, or him to communicate that vision, but at the same time, that was an organization in crisis. If you look at IBM and when Lou Gerstner came in, I believe they were, it's very vividly described in his book, you know, When Elephants Can Dance, or some similar title. And he talks about how the company was really in bad shape. I believe it was close to bankruptcy or something like that, right? 90 days or something. And he came and shook the whole organization. So the organization in crisis, and some people who had a specific vision said, this is what I'm going to do, and changed it. It's an organizational dynamic plus the leader's ability together that they can take a running organization and move it somewhere. The other point is obviously organizations having an established perspective, right? You would expect certain organizations to all, so whether we continue to expect certain organizations to always be delivering products of the same type, right? You wouldn't think they would mess up things, right? For example, Microsoft, right? You know what a Microsoft product would look like, good or bad. I'm just saying that it's, you know exactly how a Microsoft product will look like.
Oh, I'm glad you added good or bad. But that's a branding issue, though.
Right. So, but it's like, you know, there is a definitive
issue.
Vision about totally. How the whole company feels about it, right? Like everybody who comes out of that pool envisions it that way, right? So you know it.
So, okay, it's interesting that you brought up Microsoft. And
I'm trying not to talk about Apple in this. I'm not going to use any example of Jobs or Apple because I think people have exhausted it. I'm trying to give them a break.
Okay. Well, you know, what a thought that came to mind before we go on to the next question actually is Marissa Mayer leaving Google to go to Yahoo. I mean, certainly getting to be CEO of a company like Yahoo is huge, but it's also, I mean, it also was when the original founders came back to take over running Google and maybe impose their gestalt strategy. The only way that Marissa Meyer could pursue that sort of course was to leave, because autonomy, it's my understanding that there isn't as much autonomy as there might have been prior, was to leave and go to Yahoo. What do you think about that?
I do not know the background behind her leaving or what she didn't have at Google versus what she has at Yahoo. So
yeah, it's all conjecture.
I'll stay, you know, I'll stay to what I know.
Okay. That's just conjecture
at this moment. But I can say, though, is like in the context of what we're talking, she does have an opportunity, right? She does have an opportunity to go and change the vision for Yahoo.
Right.
Now, whether she's able to do it or not, that's where those integration elements come into play, right? That's what Mintzberg discusses, right? So there are all these features inside Yahoo. Can she shape those features and bring this vision forward? Some CEOs have seen, some people in the past have been successful, and it's up to, you know, we'll see. Time, you know, will tell us.
Who knows? Maybe she'll pull a Jack Welch. But that being said, I mean, we talked about leaders, we talked about enterprise versus startup. Can we go more into what type of organizations do thrive with the SALT strategy?
Sure. I mean, I think there are like a few fundamental elements for the wholeness. The organization has to be rallied around a particular singular vision about what do they stand for, like, so the values of the organization. If you look at all these popular business cases, right? People talk about JetBlue, for example, in the airline industry now. People talk about, give me a name for a customer service-centric organization, right? Now people talk
Virgin anything, Rackspace.
For the cloud stuff. People talk about innovation at Amazon. People talk about, so many companies, like, they all have a certain uniqueness, and then all the employees are very self-selecting. They hire people in that mode. They have a very stringent way of hiring people in that mode, and they maintain that value. Again, it's a question of time. How long will they keep doing that? And, you know, some companies, Grimm, right, the BlackBerry maker, I believe was an innovative company at the time that it was there, right? Nobody else was doing enterprise messaging in a secure way on the cell phone, and they had enormous amount of, you know, innovation underneath that. But then they didn't have – so the flip side of having the gestaltness is that, okay, they see the whole product, they integrated everything. Is the risk is that it can also be a lack of agility. So they were not agile enough to say, oh, look, I have a competitor coming with an offering that's very different, and it can just pull a plug right underneath or pull my carpet underneath. So how do I shift then? And so that is the flip side of this, the wholeness, right? Now, if you have a durable advantage, a sustainable advantage in what you have created, that's great. There are, and this happens when the business size is small and cannot be aggressively attacked by competitors. So I'll give you simple ideas. Like, look around your exciting coffee shops or restaurants in your area, small businesses, right? Those are excellent examples of, like, which can maintain, sustain their differentiation for a long time. Well, the first thing, they have the location. But secondly, they, even if they are far off, not exactly in your route, but you'll see that they have a very unique offering, and they compete in a market where it is hard to attack them. Like, if there's a particular food that is so good that only these guys can make, and their chef is, you know, super awesome and all that, then you'll see that they have a very durable advantage for as long as that guy is, or the girl is, they're doing that. So some restaurants can then expand that, then they can create a chain. But then you'll know when the chain is created that it isn't exactly the same as the original, right? Starbucks, if you ask me, did have a fantastic value prop in the beginning where it's like, this is an Italian barista serving you all these fancy coffee drinks. But then now you look at it, it seems sort of commonplace to me, right? Every street has a Starbucks. And so that element is kind of lost. It's still convenient, no doubt. It's like a McDonald's. It's there every street. But is that custom experience there for you versus a friendly neighborhood coffee shop which can be there? So those are kind of – I mean, this is a longer answer to your what kind of organizations can thrive in this. Organizations then have to embrace agility, and many times if they picked one horse to win this race and that horse cannot move in an agile fashion to reinvent itself, then it's kind of hard. Look at Microsoft, right? They only started with the desktop operating system, but then they went into the server operating system, and then they went into super big enterprise applications. If you think about it, Microsoft did have a strategic agility to enter new markets, new applications, new things, and they are a big company, at least.
Yeah, it's a balancing act with a lot of different elements. For example, brought up Starbucks. People like the convenience. They like multiple Starbucks locations. They like knowing when they walk in that they're going to be able to get their super duper custom drink made by somebody who's been trained to do it. But there's still that element where people choose one Starbucks on one corner versus the other Starbucks diagonally across the intersection because they like the people working there. There's that human element there where for some reason it's just indefinable vibe, if you will, of certain people who are working, who are, you know, go out of their way to be really pleasant to customers or whatever.
How different is Gestalt from having the founder's vision or the company vision be aligned throughout all of the different organizations and departments within the company?
At a high level, that is pretty much the same. But when it comes to the operational level, there is the spirit that needs to be there. So an example is feature functions for product managers, right? Product managers speak. So the founder may have a vision about this is how the product, especially in design, if you think about it, the Google homepage, for example, they have a very, very clear idea about what the Google homepage should look like. And they have launched hundreds of other products. There's mail, there's so many things. But none of that is cluttering. Each person could have wide for the space, like, oh, it's already there. Why don't I use that distribution channel? That there is a distribution in front of you. But they made a conscious decision not to add that feature there. And every time something happens to the Google homepage, that becomes a big news. You see, they did this left. They changed the stuff that was I saw on Search Engine Target or some portal recently, how Google is experimenting with their left bar navigation, you know, with the images and other things, moving it into a menu at the top, from left to the top. So that makes news. And the point of that is even a little change like that is news because the brand is associated with a certain sense of vision of how their product is going to look like, perception. In this case, it's visual in front. You could take other products and see how they do. For example, if the vision was good customer service, and then they tried to now remove the customer service element and instead put automation in it, like where you can do self-service and buy yourself, then for a certain market segment, let's say, of a product, then they've lost the very essence. So it's important for each product manager that is designing the products or developing the products within the company to be always aligned with this. For product managers, then the question becomes, they have to question repeatedly and continuously, what does the company stand for? What is our strategic vision for? Like, who are we trying to deliver these goods and services in what way, right? Why are we unique or how are we unique? Those kind of questions repeatedly address or bring the nature of the Gestaltness out. Like, a company is known for this, right? It is its brand. Show me the picture. If we lose that sense and we try just adding, you know, little by little, we change that picture. Very quickly, it'll become different. What product managers then need to do is, say you are developing a product, right? Whether it is in the beginning or in the transformation phase, they have to lay out these pieces up front and then develop it around it. Just like how this art is practiced in terms of drawing. So if you look at how this training is taught, this drawing, right, by Betty Edwards, they don't ask you to first go and draw the nose, then the eye, then the ear, if you're drawing the face. You draw the outline, right? And then slowly, at any point of time, the entire picture is sort of developed more or less at the same level, all the features. And slowly you bring it in. It's a very, very perceptual idea. If instead I focus so much on the nose, and the nose was drawn, but then the rest of the features, then what happens is my eye, I fail to recognize that there are other elements that make the face. Similarly, in a product, if I over-index on one aspect of the product, then I remove all the other elements which are necessary to enable this product actually to work. So you have to actually step back and look at it each time. There is a sense of, I'm going to read this because this is very useful, and this is from drawing, and this is in the link rightbrainrockstar.com. A common mistake that beginners make is to focus on a single area, say the nose, and work on this part of drawing until it is finished to a high level of detail before moving on to start the mouth. This method can work, and I've seen some great drawings made this way, but I find it much more effective to build the detail gradually over the whole drawing. First, block in the main outline of the whole face, then refine the shapes, you know, and so on and so forth. It's very counterintuitive. That's how strategy works too. Strategy doesn't work by picking one portion and like developing it all out and then forgetting the rest of the aspects. It's like almost this puzzle will come in at the end of it. And it may not come too. It's like my daughter plays with Play-Doh. It has to mesh as you keep going.
How about some examples of your Gestalt application strategies?
We're going on to Q6. The shout out to our tweeter, George Kruger. Hey, George, thanks for participating.
Have you implemented your Gestalt application strategies in your organization?
It is tough. As I said, you know, in most of the organizations I have worked at, I have questioned the Gestaltness of it. So what I was hoping for is as a question to the audience, like, where do you see yourself applying? Let me ask you, since you've asked me all these questions, Lydia, how do you feel about the discussion so far? I mean, it doesn't have to be, have you applied this Gestalt strategy? The question is really like, you know, here's a concept. It's talking about the whole bigger than the parts.
Mm-hmm.
And it is characterized by these two simple elements of uniqueness and integration around it, with the difficulty that, yes, it is great, but then also it has the challenge of agility in the front. How do you take this and apply it or reflect on some of the things that you have done?
Well, I've been in business for myself for more than a decade. It's my company, my vision. My vision isn't always that easy to communicate the big picture that I see for a venture going into the future. It isn't always the best strategy to communicate that. Sometimes it's better to just focus on baby steps. For example, you may have a big concept, an idea for a big project or a startup, and yet you've got to focus in the beginning on the MVP, the minimum viable product, and get people on board with that. Then you get to share your vision, the big vision. You talked about the CEOs, the founders, being the best people for carrying the banner for Gestalt strategy, because the statistics show that when a startup founder is removed, the failure rate is exponentially higher. And I think that's because that vision and that Gestalt strategy perspective is lost. I'm in complete agreement with you. I think it's critical to success if you really want to grow something, and it's also extremely difficult. You have to carry through every aspect. Who comes into the company, they have to share that vision.
Exactly.
It's an organic recognition to talk about bringing something into reality instead of devoting time to making one thing work perfectly and then going and making another thing, bringing it little by little so the whole is viewed. It is very difficult because how do you, you know, from a tactical point of view, I think from an artistic point of view, especially with clay or drawing, it's much easier to do. So give us if possible, a tangible example of how you've done this.
A, I don't want to pitch my product. So
You know what? It's okay if you're doing it in an educational light. You're using it as an example. Look, you built your product because you were solving your own problem. I give you permission.
Sure. I mean, I would take more well-known examples, going back to like Google and other places, right? It's only by observation, and this is extremely important to us, how we look at strategy as a practice. There's a resource paper from Mintzberg on the patterns of strategy. I just want to read out the last paragraph. This is perhaps the most important paragraph. There is perhaps no process in organizations that is more demanding of human cognition than strategy formation. Every strategy maker faces an impossible overload of information, and much of it is soft. As a result, he can have no optimal process to follow. The researcher or management scientist who seeks to understand strategy formation is up against the same cognitive constraints, but with poorer access to the necessary information. Thus, he faces no easy task, but proceed he must, for the old prescriptions are not working and new ones are badly needed. And there's one more sentence, but my point is this, that this is the essential struggle in strategy formulation, is that we have limited information or low information. We somehow believe that a strategy can take us from here to there. But that path from here to there is continuously fungible. It is there are so many periods of transformation and transition that continuously happen. So it only puts us in a more humbler approach towards this, as in the MVP and other ideas you described. Yeah. That is the default method now in discovering, is because your intent not necessarily becomes the outcome, right? Whatever intent you had, at the end of it, there's some other things that have happened. The emergence of strategy is what we are mostly at, not the intent of strategy. So this is just food for thought. Rather than looking at it as like, I have an answer, I would only contest like Mintzberg, like, we all seem to want the recipe, and show me the recipe. My answer would be, think through this. You know, is it really true that somebody came up with this one thing and then the end game is that? And how long is that end game durable or sustainable? And we will always come to the point, like the creative destruction aspect of it is, nothing is sustainable for too long, we all know. And then to remain a leader in that period of time, we have to pick a position for which we are known, or going, our brand is going to know, our product is going to be known. And it's a very important concept. That is the differentiation aspect. Rather than differentiation, I would say the differentiation is so overused. I'd say, what do you stand for? What's your value? And then move from there.
Well, it's hard to think and tweet and talk. But I really appreciate that you go to the source of what our my vision was and my mission was for creating this venue to enable these kinds of discussions, which we don't really have time on a regular, on a daily basis. But I must say that in order to really think about these things, you do have to devote the time, because you have to almost build the muscle in your brain for contemplating these things without being distracted by the immediate deliverables and the immediate reactions to what you have to make happen next.
Yep.
So you have been listening to the Global Product Management Talk, brought to you this week by the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. Please go to the AIPMM.com site to view upcoming webinars. This Wednesday is Product Management Certification in Singapore. Coming up is Steve Johnson talking about win-loss for product success. Following that is, I believe, Glenn Lipka, VP of UX at Marketo, talking about bringing ideas into reality with teamwork between UX and product management. So check out AIPMM.com webinars. Thank you for sponsoring us. Sponsor us. If you enjoyed this conversation, which I must say has been more philosophical and rhetorical than most weeks, please sponsor us and also donate to us. We have a space at dudada.com, D-U-D-A-D-A.com, a startup which is showcased on an upcoming episode of Startup Product Talks, where you can donate whatever you would like, pay as you wish, to continuing our mission of bringing product talks on all levels to everyone, wherever they are located. Follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK, where you will get reminders of the upcoming podcasts. We will not have a live talk next week, so listen to our archives, which you can find on iTunes. We are syndicated on Stitcher, and we have our own Android app, PRODMGMTTALK, which you can get at the Google Play Marketplace. Thank you, Prabhakar, for joining us. Thank you, Lydia Sugarman, for joining us as co-host. Go to our website at www.prodmgmttalk.com to see the over 60 episodes. Thank you, everyone. This is Cindy Solomon signing out.